Trinity Radio. Your hosts, Mike and Ellie, plan to delve into the controversial subject of religion and the paranormal.
Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray to the Lord, my soul to keep.
Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred. Powered by the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network. I'm Mike.
And I'm Ellie.
And she is sounding like a human again.
Yes. I have my voice back, people. It is a miracle. I sounded like horrible last week. You still can't get rid of that cough, though, but I'm good.
It's kind of strange, because I sit right next to you here. I don't know if everyone knows that, but I sit right next to you, and not through my headphones, you sounded normal. Through the headphones, you sounded extremely sick. So I don't know what it was, if it's the electronic makes you sound worse or what, but in person, you sounded normal. You didn't sound messed up at all. You didn't sound bad at all. But then the headphones, you sounded all sick. It was weird.
Well, that's because I'm really good that way.
Oh, I see.
I wanted people to think I was sick so that they knew my perseverance for my show.
She had the button pressed for EVP.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, tonight we have a little, I guess, a different show, but more, just as interesting nonetheless. It's going to be a little more paranormal and a little less religion than last week. So I guess that's good for all you paranormal people. And we are talking to Thomas Durant. He is a paranormal investigator. He researches shadow people and demonology, and he does lecturing with the TAPS boot camp crew. And I can't tell you anything about TAPS boot camp, so we'll have to ask him when it's time. So we will get him on the line shortly here. And first off, I wanted to just throw out there one of our fellow co-hosts and every show's biggest fan, Kurt Smith, recently had a baby girl, Kennedy, him and his wife. So congratulations to him. Yay.
Well, we didn't think that he did it by himself. But yes, hooray.
It's happened before. Hasn't a man, well, it was not always a man, but a man has gotten pregnant before.
Yes, but Kurt.
Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't count, dude.
It sure doesn't count.
So, yeah. So, congratulations, Kurt. And that's all I got. What do you got?
Yes, congrats to Kurt and his family. Let's see. Let me see if I can find it. So go on ahead and keep talking.
But this is me you're talking about. Me talk?
Yes, right. You just open your mouth and let words flow.
What are you looking for?
Well, I was going to look for that other thing that I found online.
The ruins story?
Yeah.
Ah.
Because that was kind of interesting at how this Jewish, what are they called? The people that like to dig for bones and artifacts. Yes.
Archaeologists?
Yes. Sorry, people, my brain is frying lately. But yes, she's a Jewish archaeologist, and she found what she believes to be ancient ruins proving that there was a kingdom back in David's time, according to the Bible, like the Bible says.
I just have one question, though. Why are they called ruins? Because are they ruined?
Yes.
Yes.
Can't you still use them?
Not for much more than a wall. I mean,
okay.
It's pretty much a wall with some rocks all around it, so
we dug six inches into the dirt. We found a series of tiny walls.
So I don't think the people were that little.
Well, at least we know they had walls.
Yes, they did have walls.
Were, 3 inches tall.
And they had gates, too.
I don't think they found any gates, though, did they?
Yeah, they did find gates.
They did find a gate. So we do know.
A massive gate.
Oh, I thought they just found a big stone wall, which I don't know how they can necessarily prove, but it was from that time. But I guess there's a way of aging a wall.
I guess so.
I'm not an archaeologist. I study something that may not even exist, not actual ground. So it's hard to say. But anyway, I'd say we bring Mr. Durant on the line. And, well, I guess we already brought him on the line before the show, so. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic. I want to say congratulations to your co-host there, Kurt. It sounds like he's got a whole new endeavor ahead of him.
Yeah.
Yes, it's his first baby.
We know all about that new endeavor. Run through it three times.
And I believe my governor said it best. It's not the tumor.
Yes.
Had to throw that out there. Well, it's good to be on you guys. I'm really excited about the show.
We're really excited, too. We're glad to have you with us.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to get right into it. And I want to ask you, in your opinion, what is a shadow person?
God, that is such a loaded question.
I guess the reason I ask is because I did some research, and I tried to look up the definition. And there was everything from a human spirit to a demon to an alien to a cryptid. I mean, any possible paranormal creature is what they claim they are.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because of the way that the cases vary so much. I mean, let me start by saying that I've been, over the past 7 years, collecting reports from people and trying to draw correlations, and that's where I've kind of started my work. And now I've been at the point where I've been lecturing the past couple of years and kind of sharing some of the potential ideas with people to see if I can get more stories to corroborate one or the other. What I lean more towards than anything else, though, actually revolves around the Project Stargate that happened with the U.S. government back in the 70s going through until the 90s. That is the one thing that I think generally can be attributed to what we would call shadow people.
What was Project Stargate? I'm not familiar with that at all.
Project Stargate was started, actually it was a number of different code names, Sunstreak and a couple of others, and it began as the way of America to get ahead in the Cold War because the Russians and the Soviet Union were doing actual psychical tests as well, or what we would call parapsychological tests of remote viewing, or what they call remote action.
Right.
And back in about 1969 to 1970, a Stanford Research Institute set up their own psychical research program and codenamed Stargate and started taking in people to do testing for remote viewing on government targets. And they had a huge success rate early on where they were able to psychically view installations across the world.
Wow.
And people that were, being targeted by our government. So that's kind of where it started. And things progressed. They eventually in 1995 shut the project down and made a lot of the information public, but really what it seems like, talking to some ex-military personnel I've spoken with, that there is continued usage of some of the protocols and, definitely other psychic institutes that have been doing similar experiments since then.
What's the government's take on the paranormal? I was always under the impression it was 100% scientific and it's something that doesn't exist is kind of how the government feels. Do they accept the paranormal and believe it? Or can you say?
At least with remote action, they did accept it for, over 25 years.
Wow.
They used it as a source of information, as to say, okay, well, we think that they're doing XYZ at this installation. So let's get the Stanford people on par and see if they can give us more info. And they would take that, and they'd obviously try to corroborate it with other data, but a lot of times the accuracy was about 80% for most of the projects, up until they say by the early 90s that the accuracy dropped to 20% and then the program was mysteriously shut down. However, there was, I believe, over $1 billion of funding given to that project over that time.
Wow.
So if they're giving that much money to a project, obviously I don't think that it's a dud.
Yeah.
They're not going to spend that kind of cash if there's nothing coming out.
No, that's like that whole golden toilet seat thing.
Wouldn't everybody want one of those in the home?
I can imagine
I'd feel horrible.
I would think it would be really cold, though, but... So...
And
why would... why would you think that they would shut that down? I mean, I know you said that it was mysteriously closed, but why would they just decide to stop?
Well, as I was saying, the government claims that the accuracy rating went down to about 20% by the end of the program, by the early 90s. And with 20% accuracy on multiple targets, there comes a point where they're like, well, we're dumping this much money into it. Why are we going to keep going? However, there is, you know, conspiracy theorists have their own ideas that this is still going on, just under a different project name, and that the government completely removed the layperson from the research and kept it all internal, governmental, versus going to research at Stanford or any other, you know, university or outside agency.
Right. So... why would it all? Why do you think it would drop from 80% accuracy to all of a sudden 20? I mean, that seems kind of
strange.
A huge
jump.
Yeah,
and if you look at the numbers, it seems that you know during the late 80s too, it dropped to about 60%. And, you know, it may have been more gradual, but really, I think kind of like with people that do instrumental transcommunication sessions, you start getting more people involved when you're trying to do. Contact with some sort of entity or source, and you tend to find that the smaller the group, the more tight-knit the group, the better your results in coming through. We call it the resonance of the team. And this Stanford Research Institute, this grew. They brought in new people throughout the time, obviously, and did different situations, different kinds of tests, and you know, maybe it did actually just start falling apart because the people weren't as cohesive. They didn't work well together. Maybe it became too strict on protocols and not so personable. The other option is that they just, like I said, wanted to take it all in-house and say, thank you, Stanford, for giving us a place to do it and for giving us civilians, but we're going to do everything for ourselves now, now that we've seen how it's done over 20 years and we know we can recreate that.
I've always heard that the remote viewing, like, that's with psychics and such, right?
You know, it can be, but really, I had the opportunity, because I do a paranormal podcast, and we were able to interview Russell Targ, who is one of the members of the Stargate program, and he said anyone can do it, and it's true. I mean, the exercises, he can teach anyone to do it. It's really just about listening to the minor signals that our brain picks up from thought, from ideas.
I've always heard that's an extremely difficult thing to perfect and to do well.
And like anything else, it takes time. Yeah, it seems like the further the distance, it's a little bit more hard. But, you know, in the Kabbalistic faith, they talk about the Neshama, which is an energy field that we possess, and that can go, I mean, it can span the entire globe. And a lot of the researchers believe that there's the idea that we're tapping into an energy that it doesn't matter where we are. You know, even Tesla was talking about energy streams under the earth that you could kind of tap into, you know, for his technical research. So all the ideas kind of are in the same wavelength that it doesn't matter where, it's more about the how and how you do it, basically.
So you may have answered this before, but we got into the government thing and that got interesting. So I'm going to kind of backtrack. Where did the shadow people fall into all this? Did you experience a lot of things or hear stories?
Both. What really got my interest peaked as far as going into the governmental aspects of it were two of the people that I have been in contact with who don't fall under the same protocols as most of the other people, which is a lot of the cases revolve around people that have been born with gifts or psychic ability, who have some sort of what we call shine or shimmer to them, and they're generally sort of tapped or watched by the shadow people for whatever reason. We don't know. I mean, even later on, it doesn't seem to reoccur that often, but it usually starts in childhood. The people that were involved with these government, high-end government kind of investigations or whatever you want to call them, they had no psychic ability whatsoever. One of them not even involved in the paranormal whatsoever, doesn't care about the paranormal, but they had seen these things. And that was what kind of got me thinking, well, maybe maybe there's an aspect to this that we're missing. Remote viewing, you're just supposed to be grabbing information from kind of the aether or whatever, the energy fields. Mm-hmm. But what if it was one step further, which a lot of people believe is astral projection, where you take your soul, your spirit, your ka, whatever, and you manifest it in our world to retrieve information, but it's like sending an image of yourself there. A lot of times, if you do this, you can kind of choose to look like what you want to look like. That's the idea of our, I guess, self-image. Whatever our self-image is, that's what we're sending out into the world. And since it's only energy, it doesn't matter. You know, we could look like, you know, Snoopy if we wanted to. Would I want to look like Snoopy? No, probably not. I'd probably go for weeks.
So then shadow figures aren't so much a spirit as they are just, in your opinion, of course, your theory, they're more of a energy, a leftover, or, like, is it like a residual energy? Or
no, I honestly think that there's some sort of cognizance behind it. I think that it is most likely some way for people to keep tabs on, I guess, children that are gifted, because that is the majority of people that I have come across. I've only met one or two other people that I've talked to in all the research I've done, all the stories I've collected, and I've got hundreds of them. I mean, those are the only ones that haven't had any sort of paranormal whatsoever. That's, you know, they don't, but they don't want to believe that they have gifts, and other people have told them that they're sensitive, but that's, you know, outside of the government entanglements, I mean, that's it. That's kind of what I found. And I think that these shadow people, it's just some sort of self-image, some sort of uniform that's been manifested to basically hide whoever's really doing what they're doing, because the faces are not always the same. You know, not even the same face when you see the entity multiple times in your life. You know, people have a hard time identifying them as specific people. They just know that it's something. It's, you know, usually it's the hat men or something with a brimmed hat and a long jacket, duster, and the eyes are generally either completely blacked or they're bright white for those sightings.
So how are they able to see the duster jacket or the brimmed hat? I mean, it's all – is it a shadow that has actual definition?
Yes.
So that you can actually – okay. So
that's how a lot of people describe it. With my personal experiences as a child, I describe it kind of like if you see oil slick over water, if you were to take that image and wrap that into a three-dimensional form, that's how I described how I saw it as a kid. It's just this weird black, almost liquid, but actually volumetric and in the air.
Can you tell facial features?
Yeah, it was pretty easy to see. You know, elongated, very pale. Very sharp edges on the cheekbones for my experience. A lot of people have experienced kind of the same thing. One account says it looks almost like a horse skull, but it was a person's face, but it was elongated. It looked more kind of like a horse, and they saw that through, you know, their rearview mirror one night when they were driving home.
So that had to have been terrifying. Yeah.
I can't picture that being a fun experience now. And most people's accounts start off very frightening, because I think that there is some sort of defense mechanism. I think that there is a suggestion of fear that they put out. Obviously, with the way they look, they obviously don't want people to interact with them, because why would you look like something dark and scary, right?
Right.
If you look dark and scary, you kind of put off the energy of being dark and scary, and there is always this kind of sickening feeling that people get before they show up, which I would relate it similar to how demonic entities work. When people experience what we call true demonic infestation, there's kind of that gut reaction. The only difference is these don't act a lot of the same ways that demonic entities do. They act more like interdimensional alien stuff or astral projection, remote viewing kind of stuff. So that's why, to me, I chose the more likely of the two. But in the lecture I do, I talk about all of it, because I think it's important. I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what shadow people are as well. Like people saying human spirit, you know, ghosts, that's fine, but I think that's a different phenomenon versus some other thing that's going on that people are describing the exact same thing, you know?
Right.
Well, so, yeah, everybody likes to kind of, I mean, you watch some of those shows and people are just, oh, it's demonic. Oh, it's, you know, I saw a shadow person and they're going to, you know, kill me now.
Well, I have a question for you guys. If a lot of people believe that cold spots are because there's some sort of heat energy being sucked out of an area to make the spirit manifest, what would be any different from photonic light? Why wouldn't something use the photonic light and the energy from that in the room, obviously then if it's pulling the light, it's going to manifest as a shadow because it's the absorption of all light. Right. So to me, a ghost may do that. You know, a human spirit may do that. The problem is it's all theory because we don't have any way to test it out right now.
Yeah. You can't find people that are willing to die for that,
yeah.
Really.
So you
don't sign me up on that.
So you said that the majority of the people you find that have these experiences are or have some sort of gift. They're some sort of psychic or something like that.
Yeah.
If, say, this... Let's just use a girl named Sue. I just pulled that out of my, you know what. But if, say, she was having experiences in her bedroom at 5 whatever street, and then she moves to another state, is there, like, from what you've experienced, do you think it's likely that shadow person would follow her? Or is it attached to the house?
Person. Yeah. If it's a true shadow person, I definitely believe it'll follow her. Because a lot of the cases, again, it's revolving around the individual, not the location.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So... you know, in the case of the government issue, there were people living in the home, and this entity was being seen by visitors, actually by multiple visitors. But as long as those people lived in that home, that activity continued. For some of the other people that I've taken reports from, they move and they still have the experiences. Generally, though, once they hit about, you know, 15 to 18 years old, things kind of quiet down, and then... Usually around their 30s, they'll pick back up again, or around a time when there's severe mental or physical distress in their lives, then these things tend to come back and just make an appearance to let you know they're still kind of watching. And that's interesting because that leads into a different theory that, if you don't mind, I'd like to bring up just quickly. If that's okay.
Go for it. Yeah.
One of the theories was actually brought about in 2001. There was a obviously we know Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. He had on a man named Thunder Strikes, who's part of the Cherokee Nation, was also part of what's known as the Twisted Hairs Elders. And in their sort of work, you know, supposedly they were in an incarnation back in the BC era, 1250 or so. Mm-hmm. And what happened was they believed that these spirits were negative spirits that were feeding off of the negativity of humans and maybe even manifested from the negativity of humans from the earliest times. Which is why they think, you know, that's why they come back around times when people are having a rough time or going through sort of huge distress issues. But that's just another theory, and I always thought that was an interesting one. So I wanted to just throw that out there. I like to blanket things because, obviously, I don't think, even though I'm only, you know, 27 years old, do I believe I'm going to be the one to crack this open? Not at all.
Right.
Do I think my research might lead somebody in the right direction? I hope so. You know, that's the only thing I can hope for.
And I think as a paranormal researcher, you have to be very open-minded and accept and willing to look at it in all different ways possible. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you just pick one path, and yeah, you may find that you're right, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it was right for all.
Yeah.
Because you just closed your mind to that one path. And
exactly.
And it could be that, you know, maybe they're there as a protection for those people that, you know, to kind of calm them or be a friend or, you know, maybe they are just there as a means to watch them and make sure that they're not doing something with their gifts they shouldn't.
Yeah, it's very possible. And that's another thought we had. Actually, there's... This is another funny account that I got about 2 or 3 years ago that came into me through a friend of mine, and I contacted this person. They had a really interesting story, which I've never heard of since then, and before I've never heard of it. They were being visited by a dark shadow person that had the hat, had the coat. The only difference was it had red glowing eyes, which I would say generally is more likely going to be a non-human entity manifesting as a shadow person. Just
right.
To kind of gain entry to whatever. So this person was having these recurring visits by this thing, and you know they were kind of an atheist. They actually didn't believe in any of this, so it scared them to death. Well, no pun intended. Scared them pretty bad. And one night they just said, you know, oh my God, is there anything to stop this? What am I going to do? And they saw this white version of the black shadow person walk in. And it just looked at the dark one. The dark one goes flying through the wall, and then this white one just disappears. And the person has had no activity since then. And a lot of people tell me, well, maybe that's an angel, you know. But I don't know if I believe in that, but I believe something happened there, that either he was enacting his own manifestation, his own will to remove this energy, whatever it was, or something else intervened and took it out. But I've never heard of a white shadow person before. That was the first time I'd ever gotten that story.
So you're a demonologist as well, and since you brought this up, you probably know the answer to this.
Uh-oh.
But can,
where are you going now with this?
Can, I know a demon can very easily manifest in whatever form that they want. Can they manifest in multiple forms? I mean, could one demon look like a black and a white entity?
Oh, I think anything's possible when you're dealing... I mean, I don't like to call it demonology because I believe more in interdimensional relations versus everything being just from scripture and, you know, being related to theology. Do I think that there's a possibility with their abilities that they can manifest as multiple objects? Oh, for sure. For sure. Because, I mean, we know so little about them and how their world works. I mean, we only know the thousands of years of research that have been written down via different religions and theologies as to how people worked with them before, but as a lot of demons who are actually out in the field are telling us now, a lot of that same stuff's not working anymore. So, you know, a lot of the old scripture readings that we used to do, or, you know, different types of rituals that we would do that used to work aren't really as effective. And, you know, if it's exactly how the theology says it is, well, there's something obviously wrong. So I think that it's more, you know, we've been enacting our own will to do something, and we're kind of enlisting the help of other dimensional entities to do whatever, and, you know, some of these things are getting kind of tired and bored with us, so not listening to us anymore.
Talk to the hand. The face ain't listening.
Yeah, exactly. Big old demonic hand up in the face. Dad, I also would like to see one break dance. That's the next thing.
Oh, yeah, that would be cool. That would be really cool to see. Well, actually, no, I don't think so, because I don't want to be the reason, you know, any reason to have a demonic entity in my house, not even to show me that they're really cool and can break dance, you know, spin on their head or something. Although, you just want to kind of look at them and say, well, that's silly. Of course you can do that.
Well, duh, but if you see one with a, you know, one glove on that sparkles, you know who that is.
Yes.
God, so many bad Michael Jackson jokes, and I don't think I could say any on the air.
But you actually said something that sparked my interest, and I'm going to throw it out there and get your take on it, is that you have a belief that some of them could be interdimensional, which begs the question, do you also think that some could very well be future versions of, let's just say, ourselves, or from, you know, bringing in the string theory and multiple universes, could they be ourselves as well? Or are they time travelers? You know, it's one of those, I don't want to take it into too much of a scientific realm, you know, sci-fi realm there, but it's also one of those possibilities that we could step into.
Well, I actually bring that up in my lecture as well. I talk about how, what if these are future versions of ourselves? You know, we've figured out how to time travel, you know, and somehow we're able to get back to see world events. Obviously, 2012 being this supposed huge event, that's, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. We've interviewed a guy who is a great archaeologist and somebody who studied the Mayan culture extensively, and he's like, no, it's just their way of dictating what age they were going through at the time, and, you know, these things repeat, they're cyclical, but it doesn't mean the end of the world is coming. And I'm like, all right, I mean, that makes sense. Uh-huh. Do I think something's happening? Yeah, maybe something's going on. But anyway, so we were talking about the future versions coming back. I'm thinking, with the way that we're developing and changing, processed foods, teeth are being lost, things of that nature, well, our heads are still getting bigger, not ego-wise, but heads are still getting larger, and our eyes, if we have to, say, go underground, say there's a cataclysmic event, which all the world events, I mean, we just had an earthquake yesterday, or today, 8.8, down in Chile, you know, who knows if we're going to be driven into seclusion or something. It's possible. Maybe we'll look like gray aliens in 1,000 years.
And even since just this earthquake and all this tsunamis that it's causing, I've seen in the news a lot of stuff, what's this Earth or planet coming to?
Yeah.
And, like, people are already prepared for the whole thing to be wiped out. Which,
well, yeah.
That's kind of what they also felt back, you know, thousands of years ago, too. Because, I mean, it, you know, Scripture talks about different prophecies that it has to go through. And there have been people who have said, well, all of that has already happened.
Yeah.
That, you know, maybe it's just similarities. I mean, people started panicking, thinking the world was going to end when Y2K happened. And I worked on that project, and I can assure you nothing happened.
Yeah.
I think Y2K was all... They were worried the clocks on computers weren't going to work, and the calendars weren't going to reset themselves to 2000. I think it was all silly. But we got to take a quick break here. We're going to, I guess, maybe...
Before you take that break, though,
okay.
It was more than just, oh, my gosh, my computer's not going to work. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I mean, people thought it was the end of the world coming.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there was movies out that were all about the end of the world coming. You know, every 10 years they throw some disaster flick at the end of the end of the world.
But I think if computers went haywire because of it, that would be the end of our world. I mean, we're based on computers. Our life is based on computers nowadays. I think it was pure crap.
I don't know. I think Y2K caught up with my computer.
But anyway.
And when you have a computer from the Dark Ages, what do you expect?
I love you, but bite me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here and come back on subject. So, thank you, everyone, for listening. You're listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network. Be right back.
Ross from Residual Hauntings Live. As some of you may know, I have run a paranormal group and website for several years. After walking through unwelcoming buildings and ominous cemeteries at night, the biggest challenge I've faced has been finding quality website hosting on a very tight budget. HostYourGhost.com is a high-quality hosting company specifically serving the paranormal community. All HostYourGhost plans include ad-free hosting, email accounts, and an easy-to-use control panel. With packages starting at just $4.99 a month, we scare away the competition. So stop watching your money vaporize and let us host your ghost at HostYourGhost.com.
Haunted Times Magazine is honored to have been chosen by the IPAA as the number one paranormal magazine in the world, offering its readers a look into the supernatural. Publishing consistently since 2005, Haunted Times Magazine has brought its readers the best information on hauntings, ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, the newest technology, and much, much more. Start your subscription today by visiting the Haunted Times Magazine website at www.hauntedtimes.com. Just click on the subscribe now banner, fill out the simple information needed, and you'll begin your subscription to Haunted Times with our most recent issue, featuring an in-depth interview with Zach, Nick, and Aaron of television's Ghost Adventures. Mention this advertisement in the comment section of your order form and receive a much sought-after rare back issue of Haunted Times Magazine free with your paid subscription. Visit www.haunted.com today.
This is Don Shy, the parapublicist, and you're listening to Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred.
And we're back.
Hello, everybody.
Yeah, hello. I got distracted. I'm pushing buttons, and it threw me off there. So if you're not in the chat room tonight and you're listening, come on over to asprn.com/studiob.html and join us in the chat room. Send us some questions.
Join us in this great chat with this great guest, Thomas Durant.
Oh, you guys don't have to lie about me.
So.
Damn, found out.
I'm going to backtrack to the shadow people and off of the 2012 End of the World by 2K. And my question is, why are shadow people always seen in the bedroom? At least it seems that way. And I think from what you've told us so far, I have a pretty good idea of the answer. But I find it funny.
Before the show, which we were thinking about their watch. Well, they are watchers, but a lot of times I think it has to do with the fact that, much like how people... It's kind of funny. People think bathrooms are more haunted than most other places too. Because why? Well, when you're kind of doing your business, you're all your defenses are down. You're kind of more in the zone, let's say.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think what it is we're just more sensitive when it comes to those areas. I think the bedroom also, a lot of times it's right before sleep. It's when people are either just waking up or just going to bed, which is, you know, very similar to a lot of what we'd call alien or interdimensional encounters.
And with that being said, I always am very, very suspicious of any story that starts with I was waking up or I was almost asleep. Because I know when I'm falling asleep, I say things that mean absolutely nothing about anything surrounding me, and I don't do things I would do when I'm fully awake. So,
hey, I once won a hand of rummy that way.
I hung up on the mayor of Somerset County in New Jersey right before I was going to get married by Justice of the Peace because I was half asleep. So if I were to see a shadow when I'm just partially waking up, I wouldn't think anything of it. I'd think I'm just not awake.
And I think that's a big part of why I take that into consideration. What could be sleep paralysis? What could be this sort of dream state event? Mm-hmm. However, when the stories are that consistent throughout, you know, a number of different people, I have to think something's going on. you know, just when that many case reports come in. It's like witnesses in a trial. When people would come forth and their accounts are very similar as far as, like, you know, the accused is out there doing this and that. Next person comes out, the accused is out there doing this and that. It's the same thing. If enough people start saying it, well, it makes it a little bit more, even if they are falling asleep. And that's why I think that there's some credence to it. But a lot of the times, I've had people talk about cases, they've seen the shadow people in the middle of the day out when they're doing their business. You know, if they're out walking down the street and they see this person standing there, looks like a real person, but they're just really pale, gaunt, and their eyes are glazed over, and they've got the same customary, you know, attire on. And then next thing you know, they look again, and the person's not there. I got to think more. There's more to the story than not.
Right. And the other thing I was figuring from what you've said so far with being in the bedroom is the entity is very attached. That sounds so wrong, but the entity, you said the entity. You had said the entity is very attached to that particular person, so I figured just because of the personalness of the bedroom being their space, that that's more or less where it would want to kind of hang out, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and a lot of people believe that their bedroom is their sanctuary. So, right. You know, no matter how the rest of their house is, the bedroom is always that place they can go to keep everything else away. So, yeah, it makes sense to me that they would probably go there to either contact or to watch the person, because that's when the person's going to be in their most vulnerable state, and you'll see more of the true person as opposed to the guarded or, you know, busy version of the person outside of that.
Do you find that the shadow people are, I guess you could say, shy to being seen by others in the house?
Like generally, yeah. I mean, even when most of the clients see the shadow person, you know, 1, 2, 3 times, it generally seems as though they catch the shadow person off guard, and then the shadow person kind of takes off. Hmm. You know, and it also depends on the type of shadow person too. I mean, there's it seems like there's different levels to what I would call the hierarchy of whatever they are, whatever the type of entity is that they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
so what is that hierarchy?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say. There's definitely, in my opinion, there's 3 classifications. There tends to be visitations by smaller, you know, about 4 foot tall. They look robed. A lot of people in the occult would call them servitors or, you know, elementals. I tend to call them scouts because it seems like those things appear before a more prominent shadow person, what we would think of as a shadow person, shows up. So you have these little 4 foot tall guys that kind of look like Jawas from Star Wars that kind of pop up and they get caught watching you. They're out the door, you know. But you see them a couple times, and then next thing you know, there's this 6 foot tall figure staring at you, and catch them off guard, then they take off. So that's generally what happens. Then you have the difference between, you know, what we would call more humanoid versions. You have the normal ones, which I call just watchers, because that's really what they do. And then you have the more traditional hat men, which is really, when you're talking shadow person, that's the classic shadow person is the hat man. You know, brimmed hat, long coat, that's the guy you're looking for when somebody says shadow person. That's the main dude.
Does that hat, that attire, have some sort of symbolism that you're aware of? I mean, is there a reason for that, or is it just what people...
Right.
It's really how people identify. And here's the thing. If you're talking about psychic impressions, obviously, if they're good enough to kind of put their image in our brains, you know, by feeding us information, we think of people of higher class. You know, in the old days, richer people would have nicer hats, or even going further back, crowns. Crowns were used to tell royalty apart. So maybe it's set up that way, but is there a real hierarchy? I don't know. I've never seen one order a lesser one around. You know, I've never witnessed that personally. Neither have any of the clients I've been talking with, but I think that they definitely are the more prominent figure because the cases are a little bit more rare.
And it sounds like the majority of the cases, the figure is seen as a male.
Generally for the hat men, but there have been accounts that people have relayed to me that the long dark jacket, no hat, but long dark jacket and the same face, but they have longer hair and more feminine features.
So do maybe feministic, not even really a word, but for lack of one, do they kind of match genders? Like, are the female clients usually seeing a female-like form, and males, or does it just seem to mostly be males?
It seems more to be males, but as far as like relating one gender to a client, it doesn't seem to be consistent in that sense. I mean, I've had a female client say that she saw one with long hair, and then I've had a couple of men clients say that they've seen the female version. So that I don't think matters so much as just, you know, they're part of this whatever ecosystem of shadow people there is, and that's just their job, is to be there that moment to watch that person. And the faces do generally change between, you know, person to person, like I said earlier in the show. I don't think it's the same shadow person always watching the same person, you know, same human.
Okay. So is it easy to tell, other than hair length, that it's a female versus a male? I mean,
just a more slender frame for the most part.
Okay.
Yeah,
so not as broad of shoulders, and I mean the same, generally the same height, a little bit shorter, but generally the same height, but definitely less broad of shoulders, longer hair, slender face.
Do you find that females are more often the ones to experience shadow people? Like, there's the theories of, like, what's that movie, American Haunting, is it?
Yes, an American Haunting where she manifested the ghost or spirit, whatever it was, because she was being abused by her father.
One of the first American accounts of a poltergeist case. Mm-hmm. With that, I don't actually think that most of the... I mean, I've had mixed reviews for men and women. It's been pretty equal as far as who has experienced these entities.
So what happened in that movie is something much more extreme than just... Like, could someone that's gone through such traumatic events cause just a simple... I guess not could, but do you see that they cause a shadow figure, or is that usually just much more extreme and poltergeist and not relevant in this case, if I'm making any sense at all? I'm not in my head.
I think poltergeist cases are a little bit more extreme because that generally involves some sort of affliction towards either the person being attacked, the victim in the situation, or towards the person who's doing the victimizing. So I think poltergeists are a different phenomenon. Shadow people, they just tend to watch. It doesn't matter. They are there when these situations are occurring, or when something else is happening, and not usually after the fact or before.
I guess maybe a better way to ask it is, have you seen shadow people being caused because of the troubles of an adolescent female's life, as opposed to just...
Not generally, because usually it happens before adolescence. I mean, we're talking literally, you know, anywhere from the age 4 to age 7.
Wow.
When these things are manifesting initially for a lot of the people I talk with. So that's before the general time frame of when poltergeist activity would be caused, you know, PK energy would manifest as poltergeist activity.
Okay.
And these people that, because earlier you had mentioned the fact that a lot of them are gifted. Are they really highly gifted people, or is it just that they have slight gifts, you know, slightly empathic?
I would say they've had enough accounts to know that they have something going on, except for, you know, like I said, there were a couple people that deny it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I think that most of them definitely know what's going on. They have a sensitivity. They have usually clairvoyance are more the ones who have these encounters, which would make sense, because if they're able to see it easier because of their natural tendencies, then obviously it's going to be more apparent to those children or people versus people who are not clairvoyant.
So to
have any of them... My turn. Have any of them, spoken at all ever to their shadow people?
People speaking to them, yes. The shadow people speaking back, very, very few accounts. I would say actually one account and then one recording that... that I've heard that was attributed to a shadow person. And as far as the shadow person talking to the client in real time, that one was one of those cases where I have to be careful, because it was when the person was, you know, kind of just getting off to sleep. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of events, but then this whole conversation happened between this individual and the Hat Man. And I think that whatever that conversation was, probably I have to kind of discard it, other than the fact that, you know, he said, yes, I heard the shadow person speak, which generally doesn't happen. Going to the recording we got, though, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with Frank Sumption. who was the inventor of the Frank's box or the
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how much I believe in the box itself, but he does other instrumental transcommunication studies as well. Mm-hmm. And his work with a video box where he created a closed containered video, or I should say television set, that scans within itself and has no outside receptors, came across an image of what looked to be exactly a Hat Man. It was a shadow person Hat Man, and it's been featured in my friend Bill Murphy's documentary, I believe it's called The Stanley Effect. And also in those sessions that he was doing, he received a message that said something to the effect of, you know, we're watching you. And it said something about Frank's son who had passed away. And then it had a kind of more disturbing message that I can't remember exactly what the words were, but it's all on that documentary, and I play it during my lecture as well. Wow. And that kind of startled me because it said that, you know, we are watching, and that's exactly what their MO is. So I kind of had to think that, yeah, this is something that probably is more related to shadow people than, say, you know, just a random occurrence with a box, you know, since even the audio box that he was using at that time was not tuned into AM or FM frequencies.
Right. It was too fitting to just be a random frequency floating in.
And that would just, that would seem really scary to just get that. I mean, having something tell you, hey, we're watching you. I mean, that would just kind of make you want to get dressed in, you know, some sort of metal suit or something all the time so that they can't necessarily see you when you're, you know, doing certain things.
Generally on...
I hope I've never been caught.
Generally on your, I guess you would say, investigations and when you help clients, you say these are fairly young children. Do you find it's best to try to get rid of the entity that's bothering them or scaring them, or do you teach them how to better control their abilities and that helps kind of remove the shadow person?
A little bit of both. Actually, most of the shadow people accounts that I get are via email, so I don't even get to go out to locations, and it's many years after the fact. You know, I've had clients in their 50s, I've had clients in their, you know, 20s share their stories with me. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of people recently that I've been working with that are you know, children and families that I've been helping that have had experiences, but a lot of the times it's after the fact. And with the children I work with now, I do help them kind of work through their abilities and help them to better understand them and better to try to control them, I guess is a good word to use. Mm-hmm. Just because I think it's safer that way anyway, even when dealing with human spirits. I don't think it's okay to just send a kid out to the wolves, you know, without teaching them how to use a gun. You know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
Right.
So that's just my outlook on it, though. Some people would call me wrong on that one.
It's all theory, all opinion.
Yeah. I mean, but you got to kind of help them somehow. You know, I mean, the psychology itself could be seen as theory and opinion because it's a doctor looking through a book that assumes that, well, these are the symptoms and these match that, so you must have that. And sometimes they're wrong, too. So, I mean, it's kind of a give and take there.
Well, and also let's think about how psychology pushed out the parapsychology departments, too, because they were fighting for funding.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, during the 70s and 80s, they were both fighting for the same funding sources, a lot of them, a lot of the major university programs, and look what happened to parapsychology.
Yeah.
I was going to kind of change subject a little bit. Do you think that children are more susceptible to seeing paranormal activity because they're still so open-minded? And I'll finish with that question first before I continue.
Okay. I believe so, because here's my thought. When you're a child, there's less societal influences put on you.
Exactly.
So the yes or no of whether or not these things exist, you know, some of it is imagination, and we have to weed through that with the children that we work with. But there is definitely, I mean, I'll bring up this client that we've been dealing with recently, and the family is just absolutely phenomenal. They've done everything right. They've followed everything explicitly. The information that this young gifted child was coming up with was pretty much, I mean, coming direct from old religious texts, especially Buddhism, and she has not been, what's the word? None of that has been talked to her about. You know, nobody's brought that up around her. It's not like they sit there and read her the Tibetan Book of the Dead or talk about the Buddhist, theology.
Mm-hmm.
She's just coming up with this stuff out of nowhere. And it was just amazing to me to hear that. And that's, a big reason why I stay in this field, because stuff like that is so fascinating to me. And I think that if there is legitimate gifts out there, they should be fostered. You know, I don't believe in keeping things cracked down just because not everybody else accepts it or believes in it.
Right.
Right.
So what's your, technique for determining whether this child has that gift or is just
a savant type of thing?
Well, no, not necessarily that, but just like, overly imaginative, I guess you could say.
Well, you ask the story. You ask for the story multiple times. You see if there are discrepancies every time they tell the story, and usually those facts that are different every time, those are the ones you can throw out. But a lot of the things that are the same, and you can tell by just watching their face if they're thinking in their head or if they're imagining.
Right.
Outside of that, you also test their sensitivity to energies, and I do a little bit of energy work or work with chi or prana, whatever you want to call it, and I'll do a charge. I won't tell them what to expect. I just have them hold their hand out and close their eyes, mm-hmm. and I just say, do you feel anything? And they can tell me, if they're sensitive, the kids will tell me exactly where they feel the energy going based on what my thought patterns are. They can even give me a color, and it'll be the same color I'm thinking of. Those are kind of things I do to test the children to see where their abilities are at, and then give them a variety of resources as far as whatever their personal beliefs are as to how to keep themselves, safe and to keep activity from happening in the home. Because, children who want to talk to ghosts, they may say, hey, come on in, let's chat. They don't even know if the person's kind of an a-hole or if the person's a nice person. They're not making that discrepancy, and I think as in life, so in death. There's some pretty unhappy human spirits out there from my understanding.
Right. So do you have any sort of gift of any sort of gift of any sort? Yeah, that makes sense. Do you have any sort of gift? Because you seem to know very well.
Yes, I got a brand new car the other day. No,
you seem to know how to work with them very well, and you seem to understand it very well. Is that just something from research, or have you experienced it?
I was kind of born, I would say, clairvoyant. I used to see things and talk to things that weren't there, and I thought I was crazy for a while too. But actually, my mother's first husband, who lived in the house that I grew up in, I guess I would talk to him. I never knew this until talking to her later, but I would relate stories from him, and it just would absolutely baffle her as to how I knew it. And little did I know, he had died on the property about 3 years before I was conceived. So with that in mind, I kind of, lost track of my whatever you would call it, gifts, abilities, for a long time until I got to college, and then I started doing lots of research on theology and spiritualism and got involved with doing paranormal investigations just because I've always been interested. I've always read books, Dr. Hans Holzer and the Time mm-hmm. Life series of the Unexplained Mysteries, mm-hmm. all that stuff. That was what I grew up reading, and so it was just a natural step for me to start doing investigations and working with people. And I've done technical stuff, which is how I got involved with, a team called Capers back in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. I worked with them for a while in a more technical capacity, and then started working with other teams across the U.S., getting how they do their protocols, how they do their more, I would call it technical investigation. I won't call it scientific because it's not, but more technical-based investigations. And that's why I got working with TAPS Bootcamp and Sid Schultz on that, and we've been kind of putting that together, and we're going out and doing a lecture tour this year with that. So
do you use your clairvoyance on your investigations, or do you keep it all technical with the team?
It depends on what I'm getting called in for. I do consulting for various teams, so sometimes I'll be consulted as a quote-unquote demonologist. I call myself just a paranormal consultant because I pretty much do whatever's needed. If it's a technical team that I'm going out with and they just want straight data, straight facts, then I shut everything down and I go in clean and just try to write down, what's being detected on the EMF detectors, what's coming through the ion counter, what's going all these different devices, whatever we got going on. But generally, the cases we get are a little bit more severe, so we try to help them out, and I use my abilities for that.
Okay. Well, It's just coming after midnight here on our side of the country. So we're going to take another quick little break. This one will be a little shorter than the last one, maybe about 4 minutes. And when we come back, I want to ask you about TAPS Boot Camp, because I know nothing about it. So,
sweet.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and stay tuned. You're listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop flow. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spiraled the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool and it never ends. In the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen in and hear my words. And the ones you would think I would say if there was a me for you. All alone at the 64 World Fair. 80 dolls yelling, small girl, after all. Who was at this pond pavilion? Why was the bench still warm? Who had been there? Or the time when the storm tangled up the wire to the horn? That's a bus depot. And in back of the edge of hearing, these are the words that the voice was repeating. And I am older, we still haven't walked in the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen and hear my words, they're the ones you would think I would say if there was a me for you. When I was driving once, I saw this painted on a bridge.
I don't want the world. I don't want to have.
They don't need me here, and I know you're there. Where the world goes by like the humid air. And it sticks like a broken record. Everything sticks like a broken record. Everything sticks until it goes away. And the truth is we don't know. In the glow of each other's majestic presence. And I hear my words. They're the ones you would think I would say if there was a me for you. And I are getting older, we still haven't walked. In the glow of each other's majestic presence. And I hear my words. They're the ones you would think I would say if there was a me for you. In the flow of each other's majestic presence. And I hear my words. They're the ones you think I would say if there was a me for you. And I hang in that arc and hope we still haven't walked. In the flow of each other's majestic.
Hi everybody, this is Christopher Moon from Haunted Times Magazine. I want to invite you all out to one of my favorite ghost hunting events that we do. It's the Ghost Hunter University at the Mason House Inn in Bettencourt, Iowa. It's happening February 27th and 28th. The first day is actually going to consist of our Ghost Hunting 101 class, and the second day is going to be the more advanced 102 class. Cost of the event is only $75 per person per event. Best thing to do is to reserve your space directly with Joy and Chuck Hansen at the Mason House Inn. And the telephone number there is 800-592-3133. I'll also be offering discounted telephone to the dead readings as well. Again, that number is 800-592-3133. Call today as space is limited.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks, host of that bewitching show, Stirring the Cauldron. And you're stirring it up right now. Radio, where nothing is sacred.
All right, we're back, and you're still listening to Paratrinity Radio. And I remembered what my show is called this time. if you're not here in the chat room, come on over to asprn.com/studiob.html and join us, ask questions, and join in the excellent discussion. And we
could you say that a little faster?
I could have. Oh, and then at least understand some of it. And we've got awesome guest Thomas Durand here on the line. And we've been discussing shadow people for the last hour, but I want to get off that.
Disgusting, not disgusting.
I said disgusting.
It came out disgusting on my end.
Sorry, I didn't mean that. But I want to get off that subject, and I want to know what TAPS Bootcamp is, because I don't have the foggiest idea.
Well, TAPS Bootcamp is... there's a couple versions. There's a short version and the long version. The long version, which is what I'm a part of, we do about a 5 or 6 hour comprehensive course as to the basics of technical investigating. And again, I say technical investigating because when people use scientific investigation in the title of what their team does, I kind of get skeptical because unless you're sitting in a laboratory doing the same experiments over and over again, you kind of have blown that out the water.
Right.
So we do technical investigating. The different data retrieval systems that we use, like, you know, mostly atmospheric. We go over how to use some equipment properly, the downfalls of certain equipment like the K2 meter or what we call the safe range meter because that's the real name.
Mm-hmm.
And we also talk about protocols, effectively using psychics on your team and even going to spiritual protection, which is a new addition to it this year. But people were actually interested in that aspect, so we talk a little bit about that.
So what do you recommend for having psychics on your teams to work with?
Well, a lot of times we'd like people to come in cold, obviously, because the less they know about the information of the case, the better off. And then you kind of send them in with one or two other people, take extensive notes on what they have coming in. You know, usually our psychics should carry a pad of paper around and just jot everything down instead of saying it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And let us know what rooms they think are hot spots, what information they get initially, and then throughout the night. Then, afterwards, we can correlate events that the psychics may have experienced with some of the data that we've collected, or see if maybe some of the anomalies that we pick up coincide with information that they got throughout the investigation.
So do you investigate first before you allow the psychics to go in and kind of walk around?
We think it's useful to let the psychics go in first, because that way they can let us know of any hot spots outside of what the clients tell us. So if the client gives us, you know, bedroom, bathroom, and kitchen, well, maybe the psychic says, well, but I'm getting this stairway has something over here. They're writing it down. The team lead will then take that information and say, okay, well, let's put one on the stairway. Why? Because we think there might be a potential for something there. And we'll see if we get anything. Because we do want to use them, like as Sid, my partner on this, says, we use them as bloodhounds to go in and sniff out where things are going on, and they'll let us know if they think something's going to happen there, and chances are that we'll probably get something off of it.
So that's given you a good, accurate response? I mean, more often than not, where the psychics say they feel something, you generally get activity from there?
If not, it'll coincide with where the clients get activity.
Okay.
Which
okay.
We don't, again, we don't inform them as to what the client interviews or the preliminary interviews say. So if they come in and say, well, here is a place where, you know, this happens, guess what? Client had that happen there. So we definitely want to set up gear in that room. So that's kind of what we use them for.
Okay.
So TAPS Bootcamp, I automatically think of the TV show. I mean, you've got TAPS, Jane Grant, and then you've got TAPS, Ghost Hunters Academy. Is this affiliated with those? I mean, are Jay and Grant a part of the boot camp?
Jay and Grant are not a part of the boot camp. Sid works, he's a West Coast representative and liaison for TAPS family.
Okay.
And he's got the okay from Jason to do these events, so they know we're doing it. Originally, Britt Griffith, who's also on the TV shows, was a part of it, but he stepped away to do other endeavors. And so I've kind of picked up the slack and been there to help out Sid, and there's another guy, Jason Carrasco, who's actually a family therapist in California, who's working with us as far as interviewing clients and, you know, teaching people how to do more in-depth interviews. So it's kind of like a TAPS amalgamation. It's not exactly what the Ghost Hunters guys do on the show, because obviously that's for television. I work
right.
on television. It's very different.
Right.
What you see on TV versus what they really do. But a lot of those same protocols that TAPS started with are what we're bringing into it, as well as other protocols that, you know, Sid and I have learned from teams across the country that we've worked with.
So are you teaching people who have been in the field for a while, or are these complete newbies to the field?
It's, you know, sometimes it's a mixed bag, to be honest, because we also go over how to create, you know, we're gonna talk about doing 501c3 status, so how to go nonprofit with your team. And I think there's a little bit of information there for the more advanced investigators versus the novice, but it's definitely built for novices so that they can come in and understand all the terminology and what we're doing, and then afterwards do an investigation with us and, you know, ask our opinion or tell us what they do, and, you know, we can always learn from people whether they're new or not to the field. I always have that open-mindedness about it.
So with the psychological aspect that you guys bring in, can what does he add to the interview process?
Well, Jason's work is really in discerning. It's kind of hard to say because he has his role and I have mine. I'm kind of a different aspect of it, and I'd hate to speak for him. But it's more his schooling in psychology. I mean, the guy has a master's degree, and he's doing this in the field. He's a psychologist. That's what he does, family therapist. So he understands how people think, how people work, and he uses that to try to get the best information and to discern what's being truthfully told to us as to what not, and then to see if there's any influences in the family dynamic or in the household that aren't paranormal that are leading to some of the paranormal activity or claims of activity, I should say.
Okay. And have you ever run across any times when you've investigated that it was actually because the family dynamics were causing it more so than it was an actual entity or haunting, ghost,
yes.
Whatever?
Yes, there are times where it's not even a case of poltergeist or psychokinetic. It's more a case of somebody being isolated from the family just because they are, or somebody wanting more attention that the family's not giving them. So they have the story that they've created, and a lot of times they believe it themselves, but you go in and you investigate and there's no evidence. You know, you bring in psychics and there's not even any sort of psychical energy. There's just this idea that, well, there's been a huge change in family dynamic, you know, XYZ is not treating XYZ right, and now this person's looking for attention, they're going to go outside.
Do you go back sometimes just to kind of make doubly sure? Because, I mean,
yeah.
I would think that a lot of times when you go to investigate, sometimes the ghosts aren't going to come out and play.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I don't believe that you can go to a place one time and say, yes, this is haunted, or no, it's not haunted. I just don't believe in that. So I totally believe that you need to go in multiple times and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I got distracted by the conversation here. Sorry, Mike. Go ahead. I apologize.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to throw you off. I was hoping she would ask another question and give you a chance, but So there are a lot of people out there and a lot of things I've seen where they talk about come pay us such and such amount of money and we'll give you a certificate saying you're a professional ghost hunter, or come take our class and when you graduate you'll be a professional. And a lot of people out there really kind of dislike these and don't give them much credit. What is it about TAPS boot camp that sets them apart and makes them more credible, and yeah, I guess what makes them more credible than just the scams you see out there of people charging to give someone a piece of paper that really means nothing?
I totally agree with you on the scam thing, because that was one of my biggest pet peeves, and the only reason I agreed to really get involved with the boot camp was to make sure that the information we were giving was at least a better amalgamation than just one team sitting there saying, okay, this would be cool, this would be cool, this would be cool. Now, we're not giving out certificates. We're not saying people are certified, you know.
Right.
That's not what it is. It's for people who just want to take a listen, who want to try to learn more about what other people are doing, and, you know, kind of like the conferences, give people a chance to network with other teams and other groups to kind of see what's being done. And we allow that for the end when we do the investigation. Yeah, we're leading the investigation, but we know that there's some socializing that goes on as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, I think, the biggest part of it, is we understand kind of what is involved in these paranormal events and what really makes them worthwhile. You know, we just want to bring people the best information that we can give them.
So you approach it as, I'm a paranormal investigator, I've been in the field for a while, and I think I can help you
Yeah.
improve. as opposed to those other people that approach it as, I'm a paranormal expert, I know better than anyone else, so I can make you the best as well.
And we turn around and we say, we're not experts. There are no experts. There is no expert in the paranormal field because we don't have degrees. You know, if I had a degree in parapsychology, I might then be closer to saying I'm an expert, but I'm not going to say that because that's a pretty righteous claim. What I will say is I've been doing this for 10 years. I've worked with, a number of teams, over 20 teams in my time doing this, through consults and just learning from other people. And I've brought that information to the table. If you're interested, here it is. You know, and I think that's something that we give people, and they can take it or leave it. I always believe in that. You know, you have a choice in the matter. Right. Do you want to do this or do you not? And that's fine. Either way, doesn't mean we'll deny anyone help if they ask for it. Mm-hmm. But we try to put this together to bring people into some interesting haunts. Like one of our events, we're going to be up at Fort William Henry, which is a great French and Indian War fort that has a lot of haunted history to it. So you get to investigate over there with us while, you take this class and hear some other lectures from various other people. So I just think it's a good opportunity to get together and to learn from an amalgamation of people and, learn what we've learned from other people so that you don't have to work with 25 teams to get it.
Right.
Right.
So what's your favorite location you've ever been? Because I'm sure you've been to a lot of those big touristy attraction type places.
And it's kind of funny because I've sort of shied away from that recently outside of doing the lectures because I prefer working with clients as opposed to going to these big, because what do? I go to the Stanley Hotel, I get great evidence, but that doesn't do any good to anyone. It doesn't help anyone out.
Right.
So I've kind of backed away from a lot of that, but I would say the Stanley is one of my favorites. Plus, we have local the Queen Mary, which is a good favorite of ours, and we probably are down there at least once a month. So
I would love to get up there.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, well, you guys should come down. Get a little spot on the Queen Mary. We'll tour you around in, hopefully legal fashion.
Have you been to... go ahead.
I just said we try not to break into the unwanted areas.
Have you been to Alcatraz?
See, that's the fun part. Now you ruined it.
Have you been up to Alcatraz?
Yes, I actually did an overnight there with Mark and Debbie Constantino and a number of other amazing researchers. And that place was quiet. It was really quiet.
That's one of those places if I had to pick one place to go in the United States and I had no monetary concerns or anything, that would be the place, I think.
I will say this. It's a cool idea to be locked up on the island overnight with just 20 other people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as far as places that are active, I've definitely seen more activity in, say, Waverly Hills or at the Stanley Hotel than I have there at Alcatraz.
I want to go to the Stanley Hotel.
Yes.
But who does?
Not because
it's gorgeous.
Haunted, but because, I've seen pictures. It looks beautiful, and the Shinnin was written there.
Mm-hmm. And you get the elk outside, or the caribou, whatever they are, that walk everywhere, and they're huge.
Yes. So
good
you
photo
travel.
Ops.
You travel all over the country to these different places? And you said you've been to Waverly, and you've been to Queen Mary. That's two opposite sides of the country, pretty much.
Yeah, I've traveled to some of the haunted locations, but mostly my travels are for lectures, which are college-based. I do through a company called Power Performers. I do college lecture tours as well, where I kind of show the basics of paranormal investigating to students, college students, and ways to keep themselves safe, and if they're interested, where they can get more information and books they can read, and then take them out on a little tour of the campus. And sometimes we actually do get some activity, which is pretty cool. And you'll see your first EVP you get for the night, half of the class will leave, and the rest of them will stay. The half that leave, they're scared to death. So,
are the college students in for a degree that's relevant, or are these just like
no,
for
it's
fun?
It's more for fun.
Okay, so it's not parapsychology students or anything like that.
No, there's no more parapsychology departments in our country. I think the University of Edinburgh is one of the only ones, even outside the country, that still offers a legitimate program.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Psychology took over.
Okay. They did. And not to say that they're not legitimate in their own way, but when you're fighting for funding, I guess you'll do almost anything.
Yeah. So are there any places that you really love, say, in the Northeast, up in New England?
Well, growing up over there, I have an affinity for one of my favorite locations ever is a cemetery out in Old Yarmouth, Cape Cod. And it's just a fantastic little cemetery out there. Also, you know, sadly to be sticking on the cemetery thing, in Rhode Island, if you ever get a chance to go to Providence over Benefit Street, mm-hmm. which is noted as being a very haunted street, you can walk up and down that street at night and just check out the vibe out of some of the old locations there. And, you know, there have been accounts of people seeing horse and buggies that disappear, seeing people that disappear over there, shadows walking around. So it's just a cool little location to check out. And there's a cemetery just above there that is called Swan Point Cemetery. It's where H.P. Lovecraft is buried and a number of other notable names. And that place is just phenomenal as far as activity. It's also an arboretum, too, so it's beautiful if you go during the day and then try to stay around at night.
Yeah, I've heard there are a lot of awesome cemeteries up in that area. Like, I think, is it Poe? Edgar Allan Poe is buried up in one of those cemeteries?
Mm-hmm. He actually mm-hmm. might be at Swan Point as well, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There were some cool ones in New Jersey.
I would like to go visit some of those up there.
Well, it seems like everything in Jersey is haunted, from what I hear.
The people there are all possessed, that's for sure.
Yeah, no offense to those who love Jersey, but it's not one of my favorite states to live in. I lived there for 18 years, and I can understand why some people say that, how can you not believe in hell if you've been to New Jersey?
I need to play the disclaimer now.
Yes, that's my view, people.
Well, we're coming up on the end of the show here, and I wanted to give you a chance to kind of let people know how to contact you, where to find you and what you do, and just plug yourself as best as you can.
Oh, this is the worst part for me. Well, like I said, we have a little podcast. We do pre-recorded, so it doesn't interfere with you guys. Anytime you want to download our shows, you can go to www.alteredstatespararadio.com. That's where we're at, and you can email us there. My email is tommyd@tommyd.com with one M, and I'm available if you have any questions about, you know, paranormal consulting for demonology or non-human or malevolent cases. If you wanted to share information, if you had a shadow person experience, I'm still working on my book about that, so I'd love to hear anything people have, and I'm one of the people that give full credit if you want it. I'm not going to take your story and then try to change it and say, oh, it wasn't you.
Right.
So I'm always here, and even if you don't want to share it for the book, if you just want to share the story so that more information's out there, I've had a number of people do that. That's totally fine. Just let me know, and I'd be more than happy to accommodate.
Awesome. As far as the TAPS boot camp, is that something that people can book classes, or how do
they? Yeah, if you go to the TAPS website and go under their events page, you can go through there for the TAPS boot camp. You can also go through night management. That's, I believe, knightmanagement.com. And you can also go to cityofangelsparanormal.com, and that's Sid's team, and they run that. So, send them an email or let me know. Send me an email, and we'd love to book a boot camp near you guys.
Awesome.
Awesome.
That'd be cool to meet all you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I think it'd be a lot of fun. You guys are great. This has been an awesome show.
Yes, it has been. It's been really awesome. It's
been an honor having you on the show. Thank you for taking the time to come on.
No, thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Now, what would really be awesome is if we could talk him into getting a little autographs here. Okay, now he's gone. But
did you say autograph?
Yes.
Oh, Lord, I'm no celebrity. I do not do autographs. I am a researcher.
You.
Oh, you want me to get Jason and Grant's autographs for you guys? Okay.
Yes.
I've already got those. They're sitting on my wall.
See, that's not the same. You stood in a line.
Yeah, it probably wasn't worth what I went through.
I'll see if I can hook you guys up with some new ones.
Awesome.
Make them out to Ellie, not me. I've got mine already.
Yeah, rub it in.
I think I will. All right, well, like I said, thank you very much for coming on tonight. We've had a great time talking to you, and this has been some very interesting information, I've heard about shadow people. I never thought twice about it. I just assume they're another ghost like every other ghost. So it's really given me a new insight. So,
and it made me think about the, because I had an experience before at my parents' old house, and there was a kind of a dark figure that would be in one specific room that would always lean up against the wall and just make me feel so eerie. And I never really thought of much about it until you started talking about the shadow people.
Yeah, you could very well have had an experience. I'd love to hear more about it if you don't mind emailing me.
No, not a problem at all.
Be fantastic. The more information we have, the better, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that would be great.
Awesome.
All right. Next week on Paraternity Radio, we will be talking to Reverend Tim Shaw. He is a spiritualist, and he's a radio show host as well, and I think he has some sort of psychic ability, too. But, yeah. That was pretty bad. So I'm going to revert here. We're talking to Reverend Tim Shaw next week, so make sure you come back and join us on Saturday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And it's not 11:30, folks, like our producer wanted to say it was the first time.
Oh, hush. It was a slip of the tongue. At least I remembered the name of the show.
And what is that, Mike? What is the name of the show?
Paratrinity Radio. There you go. All right, everybody. We've got 2 minutes to kill. We still need to talk more.
So kill him. Wow, that was a way to kill it.
It was dead.
It
was dead air. I killed it.
Yeah, that was a bad pun, though.
Yeah, I know.
Oh. Well, if you don't mind, Mike, I'm going to go ahead and give a couple of plugs out here.
Sure,
plug away.
Thomas, would you please plug your show, because you're a radio show host as well?
Yeah. You can catch us at alteredstatespararadio.com, or you can go to, sorry to put it on the other network, but the Planet Paranormal Network, planetparanormal.com. We're on there, and we've got a great little podcast. And again, it doesn't interfere with you guys at Paratrinity, because we don't do live, so everything is pre-recorded.
It's all good. Our podcast is over there at Planet Paranormal too, so
aha!
It's one big happy family.
Right on.
Also on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock, you can catch another one of young Michael's shows. He's the producer of
okay, go on.
Oh. Mike, I'm plugging you here, son. Come on.
Well,
you're
the thinking
producer
of the other show I'm the host of. Haunted Times Radio with Chris Moon and Dina as the hosts, and Paulette. And then
so tune in Wednesdays at 8 o'clock to catch Chris Moon and Dina being produced by Michael.
I'm good at this. Woo-hoo. I'm good at this promoting stuff, aren't I? And then tune in Monday night at 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in Studio B for Miami Town Ghost Talk with your host, me, and Jeff, as we talk to various paranormal investigators, authors, Bigfoot people, and everything else paranormal.
And where can everybody find your podcasts for Paratrinity Radio?
At paratrinityradio.podomatic.com. And
you've heard it here, folks. Get out there and go download that podcast.
That's right. And tune in Friday nights at 8 o'clock for another excellent show called Behind the Veil with your host, Chris. Tougher. What else?
That was smooth, Mike.
Tomorrow night there's Crossroads Paranormals on at, is it 8 o'clock?
8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time with your hosts Mike and Chris for Crossroads Paranormal, the owners of the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Yes, the reason you are listening to us right now.
So,
I think you've successfully killed 2.5 minutes there, Mike.
I did.
Yeah. Woohoo! So, about those Bigfoot people, I'm a little confused. Are they people with really big feet?
I don't know. but they look.
I'm not
going to
go
really
there.
Big
you know, big feet, little trail in the middle. I'm not going to go there.
But so far tonight, we've been in the bedroom and we talked about big feet. So with that, I think we're going to wrap it up.
I wasn't even going there.
So thank you everyone for tuning in tonight, and you've been listening to Paratrinity Radio on the All Souls Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in next Saturday night at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to Paratrinity Radio with Mike and Ellie. Paratrinity Radio, where nothing is sacred, right here on the All